Testing, testing. Promo for Leonard Nimoy. Excuse me. 3, 2, 1. Hello, this is John Tibbetts, inviting you to join me in the green room this Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. Well, let's be more specific. It's a press conference. A press conference for director Leonard Nimoy. His newest film, Star Trek IV, is now playing here in Kansas City. And you can attend with me an exclusive press conference in Los Angeles with Leonard Nimoy. That's this Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. Green room open. 3, 2, 1. Hello and welcome to the green room. I'm your host, John Tibbetts. Come on in. A very special time to be had for all today, I think, because we can go to an exclusive press conference at Los Angeles with actor, director Leonard Nimoy. Of course, his newest film, Star Trek IV, is now playing nationwide here in Kansas City. And it's our chance to go to a rather select gathering, 20 journalists from the United States and Canada, question and answer session with Leonard Nimoy. Now, I've had to eliminate some of the questions because his answers, I think, provide the necessary contexts that we need. So, Leonard Nimoy, talking about Star Trek IV as actor and director. First question to Mr. Nimoy is about the humor of Star Trek IV. A lot more humor in this one than in the last Star Trek movies. Why is that?
Not a bit, no. Quite the contrary. I think they've been waiting for an explosion of fun. I think we have the roots of it in the series, certainly. We did some very silly stuff like Trouble with Tribbles, which was just totally off-the-wall farce, really. And we have not done it in the films. We have had a minimal amount of humor in the film. There was none in the first film at all. It was not allowed. We had touches of humor in the second and third films, but in the second and third films, we've had a lot of Sturm und Drang and death and dying. I think that there has been a pressure building for a caper comedy release film, and I think the fans will say thank you very much and enjoy it thoroughly. So, again, quite the contrary. We have the roots of that in the series episodes as well. We had some extremely successful time travel stories. One of the best of our episodes was a story in which we landed in Chicago in the 1930s during Depression. And it was a wonderful love story between William Shatner and Joan Collins, who played a social worker. How do you like that for casting? It was one of our best episodes. Really, it was great. And again, I think that's part of our territory. What I was concerned about was that having made the decision to do a time travel story and to have this tone, that up pops a picture like Back to the Future, and I thought, oh God, we're going to be suddenly derivative here, you know, like copycats. And then Humphrey the humpback whale got stuck in San Francisco Bay around the time we were shooting our picture. And then, oh God, people are going to say, oh, sure, that's where they got the idea, because the whale's traded in San Francisco. Oh, you know, we've been working on this story for 2.5 years. The roots of this story were developed in June, July, August, September of 1984. Well, I can tell you the kind of tracking that this story developed on. It was immediately decided by Harv and I, who were hired to do a concept presentation for this picture, that we wanted to do lighter in tone and time travel, both of which we had not used in any of the previous films, and both of which were Star Trek staples. Having done that, the next question was, where do we go in time? To what period do we go? And we examined a lot of periods and thought, finally, why not go right back home to San Francisco, which is where the Federation exists in the 23rd century, and bring it right into that geographical territory, and let these people see their own roots, see their own geography. Having decided that, the next question is, why does one go back in time? And there are various possibilities. It can happen accidentally. We knew that we wanted to deal with the fact that in Star Trek III, a lot of legal debris had been left behind. They had sabotaged the Excelsior. They had stolen the Enterprise and blown it up. They had gone to the Genesis planet against orders and so forth. So we've got to have these people going home to face trial. And on the way home, they go into time travel. Why? Is it accidental? Does the ship do something, or do they do something wrong with the ship that throws them through time? Are they chasing somebody through time? Those seemed rather negative. We decided the positive thing for our people to do would be to purposefully go back in time, take the chance to go back in time to solve a problem. Okay, what's the problem? We have a problem in the 23rd century. The solution can only be found in the 20th century. Okay, what is the solution that's needed, and what is the problem? Then we talked about some very interesting stuff. Like, for example, there will be certain crafts and techniques that people can do today, crafts, things that people can do today, which will be lost in the 23rd century. They will no longer be needed. Therefore, they will become lost arts. We thought perhaps there would be a 23rd century problem that we have to go back and find somebody and bring them into the 23rd century to do a certain thing for us. Then I read a book called Biophilia about the fact that which deals with the fact that in the 1990s, we will be losing 10,000 species per year off this planet, many of them unrecorded. Many of them the scientists will never even know they existed. They won't get to them, and they're gone off the planet. Now, the idea here, and this is not a cause movie. It's a piece of entertainment within which there are some ideas. But the point is that when you lose a lot of species like that, there is a theory called the Keystone Species Theory. And it goes something like the House of Cards idea, where you build a house of cards, and you may be able to take a card out and not affect the house, take another card out and not affect the house. But when you get to a keystone card, you're in danger of the whole house collapsing. And there are some people who are concerned that certain species may be keystone species, and that there could be a big ecological ripple created by the loss of a particular species. Okay, so that intrigued me, and I thought, well, gee, maybe there's a problem in the 23rd century as a result of the loss of one of these species. We have to go back to the 20th century and get it and bring it back into the 23rd century. What is it? What's the problem? Then we started thinking about diseases that might break out in the 23rd century, the cure for which might be in some plant which is now extinct. Okay, so we have to go back to the 20th century and pick up a plant and fly it 300 years through time and space and bring it home. That didn't seem very visually exciting to me. Okay, carrying a little box, you know, perishable. It's So then I was talking to a friend one night at my home about endangered species, and up came the humpback whale. And I thought, boy, if we can pull that off, that'd be fun. To fly a couple of 45-ton whales through space, you know, that would be fun. And then there's that whole wonderful and romantic story about their song, which we don't understand. There's a great mystery, which we probably never will understand. And that led me into another area which I'm intrigued with. I think it's great fun that this movie, in effect, among other things, says there are some things that are not for us to know and understand. There are some mysteries which are intended to remain mysteries. And by the way, if there's a phone call to Earth, it isn't necessarily for the humans, you see. You know, is that call for me? No, it's not for you. It's for the whales. I love that. So that's how the thing evolved. Yeah. What movement? Oh, not really. I'm a member of Greenpeace. I send them my dues. You know, I admire what they do. I respect what they do. I'm not really an active, aggressive person in the field, but I think it's good that there are such people. I'm sorry?
Greenpeace will love this one.
Yeah, well, okay, they should. They should. And they deserve whatever positive feedback comes out of it. I think they put themselves on the line to try to at least bring attention to some important questions, and I admire that. There's an homage to Greenpeace, in a sense, in this movie, in that it was them putting themselves in their boats between the whaling ships and the whales to try to stop the killing of the whales that led to the idea of putting a spaceship between the whaling, between the harpoon and the whales. That was a
whaling
Greenpeace
wall.
Idea. Yeah. It's great. Yes. Harv and I, as I said, were hired originally to write a concept, which we did. Then we hired Steve Mearson and Peter Krikus to do the first draft screenplay, which they did. This was after much discussion with them and kind of laying out the outline of the idea for them. And what they did was created a great roadmap for us at first, second, and third act with a lot of good, useful texture. Now, I had originally been interested in Nicholas Meyer for this project because I like his tone, I like his attitude, his jauntiness, his sense of humor. And he's a wonderful, talented writer and director. He had directed Star Trek II, which is how I came to know him. He had not been available, but now he became available. And I asked him, in concert with Harv, to do the next pass at the screenplay because I wanted his attitude about the 20th century, to put it simply. So stuff like the works of Jack LaSuzanne and Harold Robbins, the Giants, that's Nick Meyer, you see. That's his tone. That's his fix on the language today and all of that, you know. And Harv is extremely good at being faithful to the Star Trek kind of historical elements that were needed in this film. So he was very good for the council chamber scenes and for the opening scenes of the film and the closing scenes of the film. And Nick took the middle section and did a rewrite for me. And when that rewrite was done, I knew we had the script that we wanted. I learned that I could do it. I learned that I could get through it and that the pieces would fit together and the picture would have a beginning, middle, and end and that it would make some sense. I also learned that I could let loose a little bit and not feel quite so constricted. I also learned that I wanted to get off the sound stages. We had been on sound stages almost exclusively for three movies, and I was dead set on the idea of getting out and breaking out energetically and give the picture a fresh look, give the actors some new environments to work in, all of that. It's a legal thing more than anything else, I think. I don't really understand. Their involvement was strictly the special effects elements, but I think it's a legal arrangement between they and Paramount.
I thought at the last minute they had done so much or something that in lieu of payment, perhaps.
No. They'll take the money, thank you very much.
How much did they cost?
How much did they cost?
No, the film.
This film was around $23 million. I'm not really sure exactly. Honestly, I really don't even know what final figure. We were budgeted at 23-something, and we're several hundred thousand dollars under budget, so it may be 22.7, 22.8, 9, 23, I don't know. In Time After Time, yeah, he did a similar story. That's right. The story was pretty well laid out when Nick came on board. The story credit on the picture is a story by Leonard Nimoy and Harv Bennett, so that was structured. What he brought was an attitude to all of those scenes, and that whole question of the language and the four-letter words and dumbass and hells and dams and that are weaved in so wonderfully. He created a great contemporary tapestry for us. The scene, a wonderful scene that he conceived, little scene, but it's a great touch, when Bill Shatner is selling those glasses in that antique store. And I say to him, weren't those a present from Dr. McCoy? And he says, yes, and they will be again. That's the beauty of it. I love that. It's great. And, you know, lines like, judging from the pollution content of the atmosphere, I believe we arrived at the latter half of the 20th century. That's Nick Meyer. He has that wonderful way of looking at this time and place, you know. He's a great dear friend of mine. We've been friends for many years, and I have always admired his work and have wanted very much to work with him over the years. I tried to get him the job on Star Trek III, and frankly, I was persuaded to stay with Jamie Horner, who had done Star Trek II, and I was persuaded that it would be good to have the continuity of Horner doing the next film as well, so that there would be a kind of a continuation of style. And on this one, I just insisted I'd find Jamie. We've done Jamie twice, and all is well and good, but I don't know when I'll get a chance to hire Leonard again, and I want Leonard Rosenman. He's an Academy Award winner, a multiple Academy Award nominee, and I think a composer of great caliber, extremely professional, and I love what he did on this picture.
And the music seems less concerned with Wagnerian arches as more light.
Well, yeah. On Star Trek III, I was thinking Wagner all the way. You know, I said, God, I said to Horner, I want it majestic, I want it Sturm und Drang, I want opera, you know, and we got it. I mean, he gave me what I wanted, but this picture, you're right, has an entirely different tone. This is Let's Have a Good Time. I'm happy to hear you say that. We hope. You see, one of the things that you're trying to do when you make a major film is hopefully step into bring something into a period where it belongs, so that it is of its time. If we have done that, that's terrific. The picture was intended to open this last June. I don't know how much difference that would have made, but we didn't get started early enough. There was a change in management at Paramount, as I'm sure most of you are aware, or all of you are aware, that Eisner and Katzenberg went to Disney, and by the time the new management came in and got their feet on the ground, we had lost about 3 or 4 months on the beginning of this project. So we started later than we intended to, and we are in release later. But I'm very happy about the timing right now because I think there's a climate right now that really is very welcoming for this picture.
It really turned out to work for you, didn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Was that new?
It wasn't really. I remember the day I presented the idea to Frank Mancuso. They had already agreed and understood that we were going to do time travel, and they had already agreed to the tone of the film. So that was accepted, and they knew we were going to come back to now. We fished for quite a while on what it was going to be fished, if you pardon me. Wasn't that clever? Searched for quite a while for the reason, what's the thing we're going to carry or whatever. And it was at a Directors Guild dinner at the Beverly Hilton Hotel. I bumped into Frank Mancuso, and I said, "We've got it." And he said, "What?" And I said, "We're going to come back to the 20th century and pick up a pair of humpback whales, which are extinct in the 23rd. He loved it immediately. He said, "I think it's a very human, lovely idea." So I had no resistance at all. And when the script was done, when Ned Tannen read it, the president of the studio, he called me and sat me down at lunch, and he said, "I love it," and he said, "Congratulations," and he said, "I would make this picture even if it were not a Star Trek movie, because I love what you've got here." So they've been extremely supportive. Yeah. Him worry about the budget and the schedule and all that stuff. It's great. I've had my share. I've been directing Star Trek films now for about 4 years with these two movies. It's a big chunk of my life. I'm extremely happy with what's been accomplished. I'm extremely happy with what the potential is, and I'd love to come in and act for him and watch him sweat. Yeah. Well, you see, you're right, and you're right, okay? But there's also there's a tone in there that I'd like to make comment on. You're absolutely right, we're having a great time. I think it's palpable, I think you see it on the screen. I hope you can. On the other hand, I never said I don't want to be Spock. I wrote a book called I Am Not Spock, but I never said I don't want to be Spock, okay? There's a difference, and the difference is in perception. The book was never meant to be a rejection of the character. If you read it, if you ever get a chance or care to, I think you'll find that it is an exploration of my relationship with the character. It deals with questions that I was asked for years, like, how did you get the role? What other roles had you played prior to Spock that might have helped you develop an approach to the character? How has Spock affected your life? How did the character evolve? How did the makeup evolve? What were your favorite episodes? Stories that I've been telling for years. I wrote that book. The title, let me tell you specifically about the title. There was a chapter called I Am Not Spock in the book. And that chapter sprang from an experience that I had in the San Francisco airport, and this is a true story. I was there one day recognized by a lady who had a little child with her. And she trotted the child over in front of me, and she said, "Johnny, look who's here. Look who's here standing right in front of you." Kid looked up at me. And there was no recognition. She said, "Johnny, that's your favorite person. You watch him on television every week." Nothing. And then she said, "That's Mr. Spock." There was still no recognition. Now, we understand what that's all about, don't we? She was using a kind of a code that we use. It's a shorthand. She was saying, "This is the man who plays the character called Mr. Spock that you watch on television." He didn't understand that language yet. He didn't understand the code, the shorthand that she was using. He's looking for Spock and doesn't see him. He sees me with my glasses and my hair is wrong, my clothes are wrong. What the hell am I doing in San Francisco airport? You know? I was intrigued with that. And I wrote about that. I wrote about this kind of gray convergence, this gray area of overlapping of character and actor that we have in our society. It happens in my work. I wrote about that. I called the chapter I Am Not Spock. But amongst other things, I said, then why does my head turn when somebody yells Spock? Because I'm not Spock. You know, I understand, but I explored it. I thought it would be fun to explore it. When it came time to title the book, we wanted some indication of what the book was about in the title. So we experimented with silly titles like Spock and I and My Life with Spock and, you know, that all tacky stuff. So I said, why don't we use that title? And the publisher, to his credit, said, "You'd be making a mistake." He didn't have the right reason. He said it would be unwise because books with negative titles don't sell well. And I said, "Sure, what about Gone with the Wind?" That's exactly what I said to him. And he said, "Well, okay, it's your book. If that's what you want to call it, that's what we're going to call it, yeah." So we called it I Am Not Spock. It was a terrible mistake. It came right at a time when there was a great hunger for more Star Trek, and there was no Star Trek being produced. It was around 1974. when the show was enormously successful in syndication, there was no product. There was no new product. And people assumed that I was saying, I don't want to hear about it anymore. Don't talk to me about Spock. And assumed that the rumor spread that I was the person personally responsible for preventing more Star Trek from being done, you see. The irony of that is that I am the only person connected with Star Trek who has been in every Star Trek project since its inception. The only one. Okay. So there was an irony there, that I was accused of preventing Star Trek from being produced, which was not the case. 1977, when Star Wars opened, had tremendous business, Paramount got serious about producing Star Trek product, and I came to work. So I really have not rejected the character. I've had some hard times with it during that period. Hard times, because there was a lot of heat that I think was unfair. But what I have embraced is the fun of feeling that Star Trek is back on track. The first Star Trek motion picture was a great frustration for all of us because we were not really being used at our best. Simply that. We were along for the ride rather than being Star Trek. We were kind of riding along inside this ship. And as each of these films has progressed, the effort has been to get us closer and closer to the kind of usage that was made of us in the series, and I think we're there now. That's what you're sensing, which I think is the fun of that. Yes.
John Tibbetts, Kansas City. Writer John Gardner has defined a myth as a creation that can step outside its immediate context. You're in danger, I think, or in a positive sense, of becoming the one truly mythic character on board that ship. Spock really can be separated, I think, from the whole universe that surrounds him.
What should I do about it?
How do you feel being godparent to maybe one of the few mythical creations in 20th century art?
I think I'll take the rest of the day off. Yeah. I feel great. I mean, it's extraordinary to be part of the culture. That's what we are. We are part of the culture. We are in the language. We're part of the culture. Beam me out of here. There's no intelligent life here. Spock for president. All that stuff is part of the culture. Star Trek lives. It's part of the culture. It's very exciting. Particularly if we can, you know, leave something decent behind, which I think we're doing. I'm very proud of it.
That's interesting.
We are trying to our best to create valid pieces of entertainment within which there are some ideas that are interesting and provocative. We're not trying to stir up any controversy or attack anybody. We're just trying to focus perhaps attention on some interesting ideas, which the series did repeatedly and with great responsibility, I think, and we're continuing to do that. And I find myself very comfortable in that kind of a mold. I did not set out in this case to make a cause film. I really set out to do a caper, adventure, fun film. When the opportunity presented itself to make some comment, look, when we, the very first scene in San Francisco, we approach a newspaper box where there's a lady buying a newspaper, and we see, I put the camera close on the newspaper, and the property department said, what do you want the headline to say? Now, this was last February or March that we're shooting the picture. Have to make a decision about what headline would be valid in December, November, December, 86. That's an interesting question. Well, you could go very general with stuff like ozone layer in danger, okay, which will be a problem we'll be dealing with for 100 years, okay? But for some reason or other, I thought nuclear arms talks stalled, which is more dangerous because there might be nuclear arms talks going on by the time the picture opened, is it's not my cynicism because I'm not a cynic, but it's more pointed. It's more pointed to me to say that because somehow we are so frustrated. I am so frustrated by that ongoing problem about the fact that we just cannot seem to make any headway. And when Reagan and Gorbachev went to their summit meeting, I thought, wow, I think they're going to blow my headline. I think my headline is going to look silly by the time this picture opens, you know, because they're really not getting together and they like each other and they're talking and so on. And where did it go? It went like, crash. And I think my headline is perfectly safe. You see? Yeah. And I don't feel good about it, but the chance to make that kind of comment is very interesting, isn't it? Can you believe that? Can you believe what chance do we have for successful nuclear arms talks in this atmosphere?
You know, it's just, it's frightening. It's frightening.
You were speaking of the recognition.
I toyed with that idea and I discarded it because I thought it would be a little bit too too precious and a little bit too kind of send up. I didn't want to do that. I was going to do it in that very first scene when Kirk is dividing the money. When he says, here it is, don't splurge, that's all there is. I was going to have a couple of people walk by the group and look back and stop and then just shake their heads and walk on. And I decided not to do it because I thought it's too much of a send up. When I asked for the job to direct Star Trek III?
Yeah.
Exactly. After Star Trek II, where Spock had died, when the studio added that shot which revealed Spock's tube containing his remains intact on the Genesis planet, which was not originally intended to be in the movie, but they put it in as an afterthought or an after decision, I knew that they would call me for Star Trek III, and they did, and they said to me, in effect, would you like to be in any way involved? Because we had no contract. They said, we'd like to know if you would like to be involved in any way in the making of Star Trek III. And I said, with all due respect to the people who have done the first two films, Robert Wise and Nicholas Meyer, very bright and talented people, I know more about Star Trek than they do. And I have directed. I am capable of giving you, some qualities in a Star Trek film that they would not be in touch with. That was my argument, and they gave me the job. Right, absolutely right. Particularly between Bill and I, and Dee Kelly and I, who play off of each other a lot, there is that. I have been saying, and I think it's true, that there are some moments in this film which really represent the 20 years of working together, the sense of timing, of pacing, of rhythm of each other's work that has evolved over the years. Bill Shatner and I did a commercial for Western Airlines about a year ago, just a bit over a year ago. And the day we came to shoot it, we arrived on the set and we had been given a rather clever premise. It was Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner as themselves sitting in a Western Airlines cabin, first class cabin, whatever, riding to Hawaii or wherever, and commenting on our persona, on our public persona. I think the opening line was something like, I've just come from elsewhere and sit down beside Bill, and I say to him, somebody just asked me why I'm not flying the ship, you know, that kind of thing, which is a kind of a comment on the roles that we're identified with. The rest of it was not, it was kind of arch and self-conscious. And Bill and I started to play with the dialogue. And within a couple of hours, we had put down a commercial which I thought was delightful, which they were extremely happy with, and it was really played off of our knowledge of how each other's minds run and our timing and so forth. And it was an extremely successful commercial. And they were, fortunately, secure enough, they meaning the advertising people and the director and so forth, secure enough to know that it was fun. It was not exactly what they had written, but it worked, and they bought it. Having had that experience with Bill, I thought to myself, if we don't do that kind of thing in our next film, we're crazy, because that's what we have earned. The scene in the truck with Catherine Hicks, when Bill says, I think we'd be better off if we talked about this over dinner, and she says, you guys like Italian. I love what happens between Bill and I. What was written simply was one of us said yes and the other said no, simultaneously. And that was funny. Having done that, so that we knew that we had the moment covered safely, we then started to explore. And we found this yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes. And then Bill, God bless him, came up with that great line. I don't know if you could hear it because the audience laughed so much during that sequence. He finally says, I love Italian, and so do you. And then I turned to her and I said, yes. Well, that's gold, you know. We've earned that over the years. Now it's a question of mortality. I really do. I think it's a question of mortality. How long are we going to live? I don't know. I don't know. If things continue as they go, we go indefinitely. The next one, it will be directed by Bill, which I think is great, and he has a lot of imagination. He has some very strong ideas, and they're negotiating with a writer. So that'll take care of another one for the 2 years from now or a year and a half from now. Not talk, it's real. They're gearing up for production right now. Gene Roddenberry will be in charge of the project. I have very mixed feelings about it. I think they have a rough road to go. I wish them luck. But I think it's going to be very tough to turn out very quickly, week after week, stuff that will compare to what I think we have educated the audience to expect. They're going to have a hard time. And they're going to do it without us. They're going to do it with a whole new group of people. So there's a question of what kind of chemistry they'll be able to create which will be acceptable compared to the chemistry that we have as a group. It's going to be very tough.
Would you agree to yes, Don?
To
To what?
Would you agree to visit? Would you guest star?
Actually, I think their intention at the moment is precludes that because they're talking about doing a 100 years later.
So your pictures might show up.
There is a line that Spock does say about perhaps that an intelligence sent this probe to find out why they've lost contact with the humpback whales. So there is that. But I like the fact that there is a mystery here, which is not meant for us to understand. I like the idea that not everything that we come in contact with is for us to know and understand. We don't know why the humpback whale sings its song. We don't know what the song means. We don't know why he changes the song periodically and never goes back to the old song. It's like the Song of the Month Club with the humpback whale, you know. I like that mystery. I think to explain it would be to minimalize it, if you understand what I mean. It would be to what are you going to say? What are they saying to each other? Hey, why haven't we heard from you? You know, well, we're okay now. You know, go home and we'll let you know if we're in trouble again. What are you going to say? What could you say that would be profound enough to fill that great mystery, you see? I think it's better left as a mystery. What? Yeah, yeah. Listen, I was pressured by some people connected with this picture to subtitle that conversation. They're serious. I'm serious. Who were concerned that the audience would say, well, gee, well, I don't understand the conversation. What are they saying? Yeah, the whale and the probe. Yeah. In fact, I was pressured up until a month ago to put a subtitle on the opening shot when that probe starts coming towards camera. And it makes that sound, woo, woo. And it's, some people said we should put a subtitle right there that says something like, where are you? You know, come on. No. See, 2001 was a great mystery film in that sense. And 2010 tried to explain all of the things that 2001 did not explain. And 2010, in my opinion, was a crash, you know. I didn't want to do that. I love the idea that there's a phone call being sent to Earth and it's not for the humans. You know, now, the call's not for you, you know, it's for the whales. I love that.
Although it's easy enough for us to laugh now about the pressure to put the subtitle on, how dangerous can things like that become? And what would you have done had it really gone to the wall?
I would have gone to the mat, and I would have absolutely refused to do it, and they would not have done it. I must say that on their behalf, because they said to me when I started making this film, this is a Leonard Nimoy film, we want this to be your vision. I said, thank you very much. It will be. And I didn't ever look back over my shoulder and say, can I do this or that? I just plowed ahead. And we had some discussion about some elements in this picture, specifically that, among other things. And I said, no, we're not going to do it, for just the reasons that I just explained to you. And they bought it. They said, okay. They bought it. I asked Hong and Ellison if he could do this picture. Early on, and we couldn't work it out because he was doing Twilight Zone at the time. He was writing and story editor on the Twilight Zone series. Theodore Sturgeon, who I admired greatly, I didn't think, well, he was ill and just passed away, but I didn't really think his tone was right for this picture. I wanted a jauntiness in tone. And Nicholas Meyer is a science fiction writer, has written science fiction and directed science fiction. So when I got to him in to give me that tone, I felt we had what we needed. Yes? You know, I haven't given it a moment of thought because I haven't had to, frankly. That's for somebody else to be concerned with now. I thought about it an awful lot going into the making of this picture. It's for Bill to decide now what kind of tone he wants to set and how he wants to structure it, really. I haven't given it a moment of thought. I'd be very. I too, am touched by that in this picture. And people have told me that they find it touching in that parting scene between Spock and the father. there, I hope there's a sense of reconciliation in the picture. Am I right? Is there?
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's in stuff, though. Yeah, that's sort of in group stuff.
Yeah.
People saw that segment they did when the father was first, the parents were first brought out.
I think it was Journey to Babel.
Right.
Yeah.
It started there. It was first revealed there.
Yeah, yeah.
Can we get back to
It's a great question. I'll give you my stock answer, which is as honest as I can be. There are a lot of elements that I think have to do with the longevity of the show. For example, the fact that it is hopeful and positive about the future rather than negative and pessimistic. Positive about the potential for the human race. Which I enjoy. I don't like pessimistic science fiction.
we do I think provide, when we're at our best, a wide range of tones. We have adventure, we have thoughtfulness, we have the humanities to deal with. I think we raise some interesting issues. If one is interested in the issues, we've dealt with ecological questions, we've dealt with population, we've dealt with prejudice, we've dealt with fear of the unknown, sometimes well, sometimes heavy-handed, and sometimes wonderfully. And so I think the shows bear, in a very interesting way, reviewing by people growing up, which I think has been important to keep us, to provide us with an ongoing and constant and faithful audience. Young people watch the shows and they see the adventure and the aliens and the ships and all of that and enjoy that. They watch the show maybe the same episode 5 or 8 or 10 years later and discover that there's an idea here that they weren't conscious of, that they weren't in touch with at first viewing. And then, of course, I think important is the fact that there is this unpredictable and, I think, unique relationship, this group of people that chemically work together well and that an audience enjoys watching solve problems together. I think they sense that we admire each other's capabilities. We have a kind of a professional respect for each other as the characters. They love the wry interaction between Spock and McCoy. They love Scotty always saying, "It can't be done, Admiral. I need more time." It just works. How else can you put it? It's one of those magical things that I think would be difficult to recreate. I was thinking yesterday. I went to meet some people who had a film they wanted me to do, and I was thinking, what do I really want to do? I want to do a good film. I want to do something that's intelligent, that I can be proud of. I will not reject science fiction out of hand. I would read a science fiction script if I thought it had merit. On the other hand, I don't want to do a silly farce. I don't mind doing comedy. I'm very comfortable with comedy. I enjoy it. On the other hand, I'd like to do a love story. I would do a very large film. On the other hand, I would be very happy doing a small film with 4 people, whatever. I'm really very open, provided there's something about it that I can care about, that audiences can care about, characters that audiences can care about, and come away feeling that they've been in touch with something that makes them feel like it was time well spent in the theater. It's the only description I can give you. I thought, I'm going to sound like an ass because I'm saying to people, well, I'd like to do such and such a kind of film, and then suddenly they'll hear announced that I'm doing an entirely different kind of film and say, that's not what he said he wanted to do. How come he's doing that, you know? It's kind of unpredictable right now. A lot of submissions, and I'm sure I'll find something. I do both. I really don't want to give up acting. I probably will be directing very soon. On the other hand, I'm developing a project in which I will probably act. I have hopes of doing a story for television, a 2-hour television movie, about a man who took on an organization called the Institute for Historical Review, you may have heard about, who are the people who offered a $50,000 reward to anybody who could prove that Jews were gassed during the Second World War. And this man took him on and beat him, and it's a Capra-esque kind of story, which I love, an individual guy who said, you're not going to bully me, not in the United States, you can't do that here. And he took him to court and beat him. And I'd like to play the role. We're developing that for one of the networks. But on the other hand, there are many immediate directing offers coming in, so I don't know which I'll end up doing first. I don't know when I'll get to it. I haven't been on a stage in 4 years. I miss it. She helped us design a couple of alien heads for the council chamber scene. She's an artist.
I wanted to ask,
there was some concern about that, frankly. Harv Benner and I felt very strongly about it, and some people at the studio, and I can understand the concern, thought, you know, it might seem as though we were hooking on to something somehow. But we have a right to do that, I think. That we have been very closely associated with NASA ever since we started. They have been a constant source of help to us with scientific information. We've had a liaison with them constantly ever since the series began in 1966. So close was the association that when they rolled out the first space shuttle, a lot of people either have forgotten or didn't know this, the first space shuttle was called the Enterprise after our ship. That was the one they used for making practice landings. They hooked it piggyback on the 747 and dropped it so the pilots could practice landing it. That was called the Enterprise. And the day it was rolled out, we were all asked to be there, and we were, out here at Edwards Air Force Base. And the Air Force Band played the theme from Star Trek when it rolled out of the hangar. So we have an association with NASA that goes back a long way, and it's pretty close. Nichelle Nichols was hired by NASA in the 70s. in their recruiting program to help recruit women and blacks into the program. We've had a very good association with them for a long time. They asked me, and I went about 2 years ago to down to Florida to be the master of ceremonies at the opening of Spaceport USA, and I feel very close to them.
Really?
I think that's when you fall down the side.
Yeah. Was I laughing?
That's an outtake.
It's there, and it's so foreign to the Spock character, and it's, I suppose, a sort of culmination of the way he's moving through the movie.
I guess I'll have to spend the next 10 years denying that I was laughing.
You were grimacing?
You really were smiling. And
well.
Interpreted that way. Not intentional. You get the impression that that was not really intended to be that way, and it's so out of character for Spock that the least satisfying aspect of the whole thing.
Really? That's interesting. No, I was not thinking funny at the time. I was thinking, how do I deal with the fact that Bill Shatner is throwing me in the water here? It was not intended for me to be laughing. On the other hand,
well, part of the story is about how Spock develops understand feelings.
Yes, yes, that's right. And I think he manages by the end of the film, particularly in the scene with the father, we discover that he has managed to reintegrate all of these elements back into his character and can act quite dignified and quite in control of his emotions, but at the same time make a very wry comment to his father, which is to tell mother I feel fine. You know, and there's a twinkle in the eye. And the father's eye twinkles and says, oh, really? Yeah. I really enjoyed playing the Spock character in this picture. It was difficult physically because the days were long. I had a two-hour makeup job, which made the day, particularly with the directing and all, a very long day. But the character was challenging. At the end of Star Trek III, all we had back in place was a physical Spock on his feet, but not much gray matter operating, you know. And I enjoyed the idea of demonstrating the fact that he had terrific information at his fingertips, and the rational side of him was really like bing, 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 but he didn't know who he was. He had to find an identity during the course of this picture. And I think all of that, the falling in the water and the frolicking and all of it, was part of that process. I think that the key moment for me was when he says to Kirk, who's trying to decide whether or not to go help Chekhov, he says, I think we must go help Chekhov. And Kirk says, is that the logical thing to do, Spock? He says, no, but it's the human thing to do. Well, then we know there's a homecoming, kind of a sense of completion. I'm sorry if there's a bad note in the water scene, but I feel quite comfortable with it. Yeah, it was tough. On the other hand, it was very challenging, both acting and directing, because of what I just said, the Spock character offered a very interesting arc to play in this movie, and obviously directing had its own challenges. You know. The one time I think we made a... needs to be helpful, needs to be make comment on what's being done rather than initiate the action. We learned a big lesson, I think, in Galileo 7. It was useful. Means in this process that on all three of the last three films, 2, 3, and 4, anything that's done in writing, anything that goes down on paper, whether it's a story outline, screenplay, treatment, whatever it is, goes to Gene along with the rest of the distribution that it goes to, and we expect to hear back verbally or in writing from Gene, and he certainly has my ear because he has some very cogent ideas about what's useful and helpful and constructive, very constructive. And he's been very... Well, no, not specifically at the moment, but on this picture, as a matter of fact, on this script, he was immediately very satisfied and, in effect, put his blessing on it very early. I can't remember what changes we made, and I'm sure there were some in Star Trek 2 and 3 because of Gene's comments and notes, but it's real. It's real. I'm very much interested in having Gene like what we do because I think he has excellent taste for Star Trek. You know. Oh, they're equal rank, but it seems to me, I may be wrong about this. The question has come up before. I may be wrong about this. It seems to me that you can have people of equal rank on board a ship, but one still be in charge, be the ranking officer, be the commanding officer of the ship. You could have two captains, but one is really the boss, you know, in effect. So I don't think it'll be a problem. Yeah.
Warrant officers don't have the same kind of rank that a regular commissioned officer.
No. now, you see? You see?
What do you think the Star Trek crew would think of Star Wars?
What do we think of Star Wars?
Yeah, what do you think the characters would think of?
We're very different. We are very different from Star Wars. I think we're grateful to Star Wars for having come along when it did, because Star Wars created, or showed us that there was a market, showed Paramount.
No, I'm sorry, what do you think of SDI?
Oh, the SDI program. Well, that's very interesting. That's interesting. I haven't discussed it with the other people. I can give you some personal reflections. I know scientists who don't think it will work physically. I think that it reflects a certain kind of what intrigues me about it, and I think to a certain extent some of this thinking has crept into this movie. What intrigues me about it is that we have in our society a tendency to assume that whatever we decide we want to do, or whatever problem is creeping up on us scientifically, when we decide to get it fixed, we can turn to the scientific community and say, okay, here's the bucks, fix it, do it. Seems to me that right now, while the president is using SDI as a bargaining chip, quote, in these negotiations and discussions, and refusing to drop it while Gorbachev is saying slow down for 10 years and don't do it, seems to me at the same time he's saying, no, we're going to do this, there are scientists sitting there saying, who, me? I don't know how to do that. The attitude is, whatever we decide we want them to do, they're going to do it, you see. And evidently the Russians believe it enough to talk about it as though it's real and valid. But I know scientists would say it really will never really work. I don't know.
Do you know anyone who do think it would work?
Well, we hear them in the press. But aren't there scientists who would like to have a lot of bucks rolling into their programs? Say, you give me the money, man, we'll get it done for you. You know, they're human too.
Do you feel that the